What's happening, y'all, and how the hell might y'all be doing? Thanks for tuning in to the Crash Bang Boom podcast, where today's guest is drummer Mike Truscott, who presently plays with the English proto-stoner prog band Wishbone Ash. Wishbone Ash has been celebrating over 50 years of music and doing a hell of a lot of touring to boot. Mike and I actually caught up while he had a break from said touring, pre-soundcheck that is, and in Europe, where we talked about how he got the gig, to our mutual love for Def Leppard and Guns N' Roses, the wave of influence from the Beatles, London and New York similarities, and much more. Wishbone Ash tour dates in the States start October 27th and can be found on all socials as well as wishboneash.com. Link in this here description as well if you're looking for it or happen to need it. Hope y'all dig the convo. Today's episode is sponsored by oneuploops.com. Drummer, producer, and more, Carson Gant and his team spent an incredible amount of time recording over 430,000 shaker, tambourine, and hi-hat loops at every possible tempo and multiple feels with incredible mics and outboard gear for you to pick and choose. It's organized for you to find exactly what you need with just a few clicks, and everything feels and sounds incredible. You can sign up for free to check it out and gain full access to all 430,000 loops starting at just $6 a month thereafter. No download limits, whatever you want, whenever you want. New loops, one-shots, and drum breaks are being added weekly. Definitely a great addition to the arsenal of any drummer and or producer, and I can vouch for that myself. So check it out, and that's oneuploops.com. Crash Bang Boom podcast can be found on basically all streaming platforms as far as I know. Feel free to check out any of the previous 260-plus episodes and give me a like and or a subscription and or a positive review. And if you aren't already following me on Instagram or Facebook, that's Jody Smith Crash Bang Boom on Insta and Crash Bang Boom Podcast on Facebox. So without further ado, Mike Truscott, Wishbone Ash, Stoner Proggy Guitar Minis, yes please, Crash Bang Boom.
Crowds go mad with joy.
All right, I'm here with Mike Truscott of Wishbone Ash. Mike, what's going on, man? You're in a hotel room. You're amidst some shows with Wishbone Ash in the UK, heading out to Portugal, ultimately coming to the States. I guess tell me a little bit about where y'all have been thus far and then where you're going, even though I kind of gave a little bit of a way there.
So we're kind of towards the end of this UK tour. So show 27 tonight out of 29. So we're in Bristol.
Okay.
So yeah, we've kind of had a really good tour, actually. It's been really good. It's well rooted, so it's not too crazy on the journeys and all that kind of stuff.
Gotcha.
Shows have been great. So yeah, that's kind of where we are now. Previous to that, this year we've done a couple of tours in the States. We've been to various festivals in France, Germany, Switzerland as well, I think we did.
All right.
Like you say, Portugal coming up as well before coming back to the States.
Damn.
And then we see the year out with a week in Holland and Belgium.
Okay.
Get back just in time for Christmas. And then we have a short break and then we go out on a 5 or 6 week European tour.
Which, damn.
Yeah. Takes in Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Denmark, Norway, and Luxembourg, I think.
Wow. Damn, man. I had no idea that it was that busy of a schedule for y'all, man, especially after, 50 years plus of, since the first self-titled record came out in 1970. That's insane. Yeah. That's a pretty strong clip for a relatively older band,
Yeah. The band's always been busy even before I joined the band. I can remember looking at the schedule of the band thinking, how the hell do you do that? That is crazy, Yeah. And then I find myself amongst the craziness and particularly in the last couple of, I think there's like the pent up demand from COVID,
Right.
You're kind of driving things. And then we've had the celebration of the 50 years of the Argus album last year.
Right.
I think that really, really, drove people out to the shows.
Yeah.
And then this year it's been the 50th anniversary of the Live Dates album. And then we've done this re-recording of the Live Dates album. So our version of Live Dates Live, as it's called, mm-hmm. which is kind of just a homage to that. We recorded that at Daryl's house down in Pawling, New York.
Okay.
So that's kind of part of this tour and what's going on. So it's it's busy. I think in total it's something like, I think in a calendar year or so it'll be something like 130 shows, something like
wow
that. So yeah,
impressive, man. What's your introduction to Wishbone Ash's music? I can tell you mine. I had a buddy of mine that gave me a a sort of compilation CD, you know, back when you would still make compilation CDs and give friends physical copies of either cassettes or CDs, et cetera. So that dates myself to some degree. But on that, along with a bunch of awesome 70s stuff that he turned me on to, whether it was like Budgie or the first Rush record or like Frigid Pink or some of those what I call sort of proto-stoner, semi kind of like proggy bands. One of the songs on there was Queen of Torture off of the first record.
Yeah.
I was shocked, and I have some questions about it because prior to them, only the Allman Brothers were a band that I had ever heard that had dual guitar lead lines that also did harmonies, et cetera. It was really just Allman Brothers, and then when I heard Wishbone Ash, so I was really surprised that I wasn't really familiar with them prior to that. But like, what was your introduction to their music?
You know, I can remember hearing. Particularly Blowing Free was a song I'd heard as a kid without it knowing it was Wishbone Ash. It was just
interesting.
That was just because it was a radio hit, I guess, really, you know, traditionally Wishbone Ash is not necessarily a radio hit band.
Totally.
You know, but that was song that I can remember hearing and even actually playing and, or trying to play on guitar. I'm not a great guitar player by any stretch, but you know, even I'd be like, I think I know this song. What is this song? But I never really knew it was them. You know, so that was like when I was a kid. But then my main introduction to the band was actually through Mark Abrahams, who's the guitarist.
Right.
You know, I met Mark when I was about 22. We worked together in a guitar store.
Oh, okay.
And he's been a fan and followed the band since he was a baby, basically, because his dad introduced him to the band. And so he would play it to me and talk to me about the band and stuff. So that was my kind of introduction into Wishbone Ash at that point.
Right.
And then I was listening to some of the albums, but then I was diving into various other forms. And, but then over time it kind of just picked up and I found myself kind of, you know, listening to the albums, listening to things and kind of just stumbling upon it, I guess, more than, you know, actively seeking it. I don't know. It kind of found me in some ways.
Same thing with me. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it was kind of a strange thing in that sense. But then when Mark joined the band in 2017, that kind of then really put it in front of me again.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually went to see the band for the first time with Mark in it at BB King's Manhattan. You know, because we'd said for ages, you know, we're going to go to New York at some point together. We're going to go do this. We're going to do that. So when that came up, we'd not done that yet. So when it came up, I said, well, I'm going to come see you in New York. I said, we said we were going to go to New York, so I'll be there.
Nice.
And then from that point, I kind of met Andy and Bob and Joe, who was the drummer at the time. Mm. And so over that time, you know, I was going to more concerts, you know, I was seeking out the records. So then it did become something I actively was enjoying with no idea at that point that, you know, I'd be sat where I am now as a member of the band, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of, I guess, how I've come across it, you know?
I mean, I like I said, I mentioned the Allman Brothers because, again, that was more of a, especially I'm from the South, so Southern rock and all of that was far more present, I would say, than maybe kind of the proggier stuff. I don't know if that was more of a thing on the radio in England, especially because so many of those bands I feel like were coming from there. But it, for sure, coming living and growing up in the South, the Allman Brothers was one of those bands that I heard. But have you talked to any of the Wishbone Ash guys to see if the Allman Brothers were an influence on them? Because, I mean, the first Allman Brothers album came out a year prior in 69. So then the self-titled Wishbone Ash comes out in 70. I'm just curious. And I know that they did shows back in the day, to my understanding, as well. Have you talked to them at all about that?
You know, Andy talks about it on stage, actually.
Okay.
Every now and again, it'll come up. So we've not necessarily had a conversation about it, but it does come up. There's definitely, you know, an affiliation there, I think, with them, you know, and certainly massive mutual respect, I would say, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny. I've not actually talked directly to Andy about that. But, you know, but yeah, you're right. Wishbone Ash was the UK side and Allman Brothers was the US side of things.
It kind of seems like it. Yeah, it's super cool though. And I'm just a fan of early 70s rock. I've got, you know, at this point, I'm assuming around 600 records of which I would, two-thirds of them are probably, you know, from like 1968 to 76 or 78, you know, definitely that decade or so. But also in 70, two other English bands that put out records that year, same as Wishbone Ash, was Deep Purple put out the In Rock record, and Black Sabbath put out their first record. Mm-hmm. So, like, holy moly, 70 was, what a crazy year. I don't know how old you are, but were you into either of those records or around to see some of the reverberations?
I wasn't even born then. I was, I'm a 1980s.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm older than you. Okay.
Yeah, I'm 42. I was born in 1980. So.
Oh, okay.
Do you know, the rock side of things came for me far later. You know, it was my early records were very, I guess, kind of chart driven at the time. Over here, we had Top of the Pops, you know, every Thursday night.
Right.
I'd tune in, and that would be, at the time, that was my, I don't know, spectrum of music. That's what I thought the music was. I didn't know this wider, you know, kind of spectrum of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think the first record I ever bought, I think I'm right in saying this, is Terence Trent D'Arby.
Really? What a weird one.
That was the first record I ever bought.
I do love that. I love that song too. He changed his name, by the way. I don't think he's Terence Trent D'Arby anymore.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't.
Yeah, I believe he changed his name. I don't know if that was for a record deal or religious or what. I want to say he's no longer. Like, if you look it up on streaming services, I don't think it comes up as Terence Trent D'Arby. But you can look up Wishing Well or Sign Your Name Across My Heart or the other, one of the other hits that he had. Yeah.
Yeah, that was my first record. At first, actually, I can remember thinking that it was Level 42 we're running in the family. Uh-huh. But my brother actually corrected me and said, no, that's my record. You know, and we found it recently in an old case.
Oh, wow.
And sure enough, from it actually has his name written on it. You know, he must have taken it to a school, some school disco or something, you know, back in the day when you took your own records and, you know, that's how it worked. And so I'm like, yeah, all right, I'll give you that one. I think that one is definitely yours. So yeah, Terence Trent D'Arby was the first one. But yeah, so the rock thing, it actually came much later for me, really. And never, it's odd. I think a lot of my musical things have never really come by choice. They've almost just fallen towards me, or you know, it's a strange thing. It's something I've not really ever thought that much about, I guess. But
yeah,
you know, I guess I grew up listening particularly to bands like the Beatles, the Who, but not because of any drummer or anything. It was just I liked the music, you know. It was really just, you know, quite, that was it was as simple as that. But then yeah, bands like Purple, Whitesnake, Motley Crue, Def Leppard.
Yeah.
Def Leppard actually is probably the first band when I was in my teens. I was like, Def Leppard and Guns N' Roses were,
of course,
like the big ones. And, you know, it was kind of, there was almost like two camps. You were either the Guns N' Roses guy or you were the
Def
Leppard guy.
Yeah.
And at the time, I definitely fell into the Def Leppard style.
Gotcha.
And I think probably because I was, I mean, they're probably a little bit more poppy.
I would say so.
You know, so I think that's probably why I kind of fell towards that side. Later on, I got massively into Guns N' Roses and, you know, Crew and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So
LA rock and roll.
The LA rock scene and all that kind of stuff. So
interesting. I remember in 87, I guess I would have been 11 years old when Appetite for Destruction came out. And I just never stopped listening to it. Another great record that came out in 87 was The Cult, the Electric album. Super, super rock and roll, AC/DC inspired, Rick Rubin. And it was like, I listened, those two were just on constant rotation. It was like Appetite for Destruction and Electric just constantly. So I do get it. And it's funny you mentioned Def Leppard as well. When I was a kid, I was kind of like, these guys are kind of pussies. And then I actually saw some video of them like in the late 80s, mid 80s. And they were singing their harmonies and everything was so nailed and they were kicking so much ass. I realized maybe I need to go back and like listen to this.
Yeah.
So I got High and Dry and Pyromania. I had Pyromania as a kid on vinyl.
Yeah.
Not High and Dry. And I love High and Dry. Side one in particular, High and Dry just destroys. It's so rock and roll. And again, I don't think they got enough credit for really nailing their live show. Likely better, especially if they were affiliated with like the hair metal thing. I've watched videos of all those bands. I don't know that any of them played their material live better than Def Leppard.
Yeah, they nailed it, didn't they?
They nailed the shit out of it, yeah. not fucking around.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I loved them. I mean, I had tapes actually predominantly at the time. I was just buying tapes, you know, so that I could take it with me everywhere I went with a Walkman, you know.
Of course.
And, you know, I was like devastated if one got chewed slightly, you know, I'd give the tape to my mum with a pencil so she could try and, you know, yeah, reel it back in for me,
absolutely,
you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it was, but yeah, their stuff was great. A massive influence, actually, I guess, in many ways. Again, without really... Mm-hmm. knowing it at the time, you know, as you often don't, actually, I guess, with influences, you know, they just kind of sink into your soul, don't they, you know?
Right, exactly.
If I really think about that, probably is the first real rock band that I can say absolutely I went out to buy their albums.
Gotcha. Interesting.
I've not really thought about that before, but yeah, that without a doubt, that is the first band. Yeah, I went out and I went, I want all those albums, and I did. I bought the lot.
Wow.
Some I can remember some of them we bought when we were on holiday in Canada. I was like going into all these record stores and buying the tapes that for whatever reason I couldn't get here.
Weird.
Yeah, I was like, I couldn't find them here, but I found them Ontario or somewhere. And in actual fact, they were playing. That was one thing I remember, that they were actually playing there the night, one of the nights we were staying there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were staying, had rumored to be staying in the hotel we were staying at. I never got to meet them.
Oh, damn.
But just the fact that they were there was, I can remember, I think I was 13 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember thinking, oh, what would it be like if I met, you know, Rick Allen or something? And then, but it never happened, you know?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Def Leppard, without a doubt.
I feel like the States and England have always had this kind of funny relationship in that, you know, there's been blues-influenced music that came back to you know, from England to the States, and we went crazy over it. And even the biggest example would be like the Rolling Stones and some of these guys getting like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf to open up for them, and people in the States being like, wow, this is great, where are these guys from? And like, right here. You know,
yeah,
just somehow we were just not there's myriad reasons, I suppose, but it was so crazy that we'd be so ignorant as to some of the music that came here right within our own country. But in particular, when I talk to drummers of a certain age, and it's something that I've mentioned a lot throughout the episodes over the years, everyone of a certain age seems to point to Ringo Starr being on the Ed Sullivan Show. And, you know, just I always kind of joke that between him looking like he was having so much fun and the screaming girls, every dude was probably like, well, you know, I could have fun and maybe get laid. Clearly where I'm working, that ain't happening. So maybe this is the route I need to take in life, you know? Did Ringo have like that kind of impact there, like noticeably in England as well?
Do you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think he probably did. To me, there was no, it kind of sounds like sacrilege really to say he wasn't a big influence on me, but again, as a drummer, he wasn't.
Right.
As a band, yes.
Sure.
As a band, I loved the music. I didn't look at Ringo and he wasn't like the reason I started playing drums, you know?
Yeah.
But I think over here, just generally speaking, the Beatles were just, I mean, they were just huge,
okay,
you know, at that time. And so I think there was an influence across, you know, some people would cite Paul, some people would say George, you know, I think,
right,
you know, I mean, I think drummers of that time, I imagine Ringo was a massive, you know, influence on the reason why they decided to, you know, pick up a pair of sticks, you know, in the same way that, you know, later on Bonham would have been, you know.
Absolutely. Neil Peart at some point as
Neil
well.
Peart, yeah. Keith Moon.
Oh,
you know,
it's for like, sure.
Without a doubt, I think they would have been, you know, big reasons. Yeah, but for me personally, even now, I don't necessarily listen to the Beatles and analyze the drum parts. I just love listening to the songs.
Totally. I mean, that's the idea for sure.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so it's just not very drummer thing to say, really, is it? But
yeah, I mean, sometimes I'll be like, wow, they really muffled the shit out of those drums. Or I'll think, oh, that's kind of a funny fill. But to your point, yeah, I don't listen to the Beatles necessarily for that. It's just more sort of the whole experience you know, the instrumentation and for sure the vocal harmonies, and just the production and just overall product and album. And I mean, what's freaky is, people forget, I think they put out almost every record that they ever released about within like a 10-year time span.
Yeah, I think it was about 10, 9 years, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very short.
Which is
time,
insane when you look at that. That, I mean,
yeah.
I've always joked about, like, yeah, Judas Priest put out one a year for like 7 years, and then I looked at the Beatles and I was like, how is that even possible?
Yeah.
You know, I sort of get it once they stopped and then they weren't playing live and then they were just doing studio albums. But then at that point, to me, that's when I started loving the albums that much more. They were just focused on being a studio band, you know, but everything from Revolver to Abbey Road and, you know, wow.
Yeah, they're incredible. I watched the Let It Be documentary that's on Apple.
Yeah, the, like, 5 hours of footage.
Yeah. It's an epic one, but I was watching it when we were, I think it was the European tour earlier this year, so I just sat around watching, you know, Netflix and all that kind of stuff. So I got into it, and it's a wonderful watch.
Yeah.
You know, as a fan of the band, it's great. As a fan of music, it's great, because you just see the intricacies of their relationships and the tensions that you could see were there.
Yoko eating croissants while reading a paper while she's sitting in the middle of the Beatles trying to write a record. I don't suppose that helped.
Yeah, it seemed kind of odd, but it was a really great watch. It's an inspiring documentary, you know?
Yeah.
It really is.
It was cool, the moment where Paul brings in Let It Be and he's kind of fleshing it out at the piano and you're like, shit, that's where that song started?
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Wow.
Absolutely. No, that's a great one. It was well worth the dedication of time, you know. But saying that, I was sat driving around somewhere, you know, so it was like I had time on my hands. But yeah, it was a great way of passing time, should I say.
Yeah. Did you, you mentioned going to New York to see Wishbone Ash. Was that your first time going to New York?
No, I'd been to New York a handful of times before, actually.
Okay.
Just, you know, on the vacations. Mm-hmm. So I knew New York pretty well at that point. I'd maybe been four or five times.
Okay.
But I'd only actually seen one gig prior to that, which I was there with a friend. We were walking up the street and we went past Radio City and I remember seeing on the boards Aretha Franklin.
Oh, wow.
was playing. And I was like, wow, could you imagine? That'd be really cool to see that. But I bet that'd be sold out, you know. So we said, well, we'll go check. So we went to the box office. Said, oh, is there any tickets for the show available? I said, yeah. Where do you want to sit? It was like, and I'm like, what do you mean, where do I want to sit? Surely this is nearly sold out. And it was busy, but it wasn't, you know, getting a ticket was not going to be a problem.
Right.
So we said, well, yeah, we'll go. They weren't expensive as far as, I can't remember what they were, but they didn't strike me as expensive. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered whether it was that thing where in New York, it kind of, you get so much music, so many bands and artists kind of pass through there. You're spoiled for choice that maybe it's kind of taken for granted or whatever. I don't know.
I lived there for 15 years and just like, you got to pick and choose, you know, you can't go to them all.
You can't go to them all. So we went, and that was my first time in Radio City, first time seeing her, and she just blew me away. It was awesome.
Wow.
So then, yes. But then the second time was, yeah, absolutely. To see Mark and the band BB King's.
Nice. Oh. I have yet to go to England. It's up there. I want to do the whole, like, Scotland, England, you know.
Oh, okay.
Do the things. Just haven't made it happen yet. But do you feel like there's maybe a connection between New York and England?
You know, I think there's a big connection between America and England, really.
Right.
We have kind of Americans here. You always feel like a connection with them. I don't know what that is or where that comes. I mean, I first went to America when I was 7 or 8 to Florida, you know, to do the Disney holiday thing as a family.
Right.
And I just remember falling in love with America.
Really?
It wasn't just the Disney thing. It was just America is so cool. You know,
interesting.
Everything was bigger. Everything was better.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like, you know, and then over the years, started going up to, you know, going to New York, going to Los Angeles, going to different places. I think there's a definite connection between the US and England, UK, you know, full stop.
Right.
With New York, I think it's certainly a place that if people think of going to America, that's probably number one on their list, I would imagine, you know. Because it's so iconic.
It is. And it's iconic. It's also ironic because it's about the most expensive city in the United States. So people come in to get out of whatever situation that they've come to get out of. They've left whatever their background situation is economically, socioeconomically, et cetera.
Yeah.
New York can be one of the most intimidating places, I would say, that you could move to in the United States. So if that's the place where you start, it's that could be a rough start. you know?
Yeah, it can be. But I think, you know, people over here just love New York. It's just, I mean, you see it on telly so much, you know, in the movies. So I think it's kind of a natural place for people to start. In the way that, you know, when people come from the States to England, most people will start in London.
Right.
But at the same time, they say, oh, we've been to England. Where did you go? Went to London. Did you go anywhere else? No. Well, you didn't really visit England then. You visited London.
Right.
Which is wonderful. I love London. Nothing against London at all. But it doesn't necessarily represent England.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. In the way that New York doesn't represent America.
Definitely not. No.
Then America is so big, I don't think anything necessarily represents
that's,
America.
Yeah, that's another, you know, problem with that for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, but yeah, you know, if you come over, absolutely, London is superb. You know, it's a wonderful place to visit and see. But if you get out and you go into the countryside a little bit,
that's where I'd like to go.
Then you really see a different side of England. So you get a real feel for what it's like. You know, in the same way with the States, you know, going to Florida doesn't represent the US. So then you go to New York and you're like, oh my God, this is crazy. You know, and then you go to Los Angeles or you go to San Diego and everyone's, you know, a little bit more chilled out and laid back. And
sure.
It's like, all right, is this the same place? You know, it's like,
it's pretty different.
It's awesome.
People are definitely more intense on the Northeast coast for sure. That is real. Especially coming from the deep South where everybody is real slow moving. I was probably the fastest walker in all the South. So when I went to New York, I was like, all right, these people walk pretty fast. I'm like, I was kind of into it. They're like generally impatient when they drive. I have road rage. I was like, all right, I can wrap my head around a few of these things other than just how many fucking people there are everywhere. That was overwhelming. You know, tall buildings, people yelling at each other, cars honking, just the general like atmospheric intensity of New York, especially Manhattan. And I worked there. I would commute in and take the subway. So then it's like you're dealing with the riffraff on the subways. You get out. And then it's just intensity, you know, immediately. It was a strange place, man. But I'm glad I was able to endure it for 15 years when I could, you know.
You did well.
Absolutely. Well, what area of England did you grow up in then?
Okay, so I was born in Cornwall, which is right down in the southwest, which is kind of like, I guess, in terms of you would compare it to the States, that's the chilled out, laid back bit. So it's kind of, I mean, it's not California by any stretch, but it's got that. Everything just takes a step back down there, you know. It's pretty chilled out. When I was maybe 5 or 6, my parents moved up to, we actually lived in Wales for a short period, just literally over in the border in a town called Chepstow.
Oh, interesting.
So not too far from where I am now, actually. And then by the time I was, I think it was about 7 or 8, we'd moved to Yorkshire, which is where I still live now, which is near... we lived in a town called Wetherby, which is in between the cities of Leeds and York. So Yorkshire's the biggest county in the UK.
Okay.
Which is still very small compared to anything in the States, you know, but it's for us, it's a big county. So yeah, I mean, in terms of geographically, it kind of puts us right in the middle of the country. Indeed, Wetherby was known, I believe, as literally the halfway stopping point between London and Edinburgh. That was halfway.
Wow.
So it was famed, you know, way back in the day for that's where the coaches and the, you know, the horses, et cetera, would stop and they would, you know, take a break and then they would continue their journey up to Edinburgh because it was exactly halfway.
Yeah. You mentioned horse and carriages and stuff. I had an English friend that we were talking about music and she said garage rock. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then I realized, garage. Oh, my God.
Garage. Yeah. Yeah.
You just made me think about that. I haven't thought about that since she said it. Oh, my God. I was laughing so hard. I couldn't believe it. I had never heard. I'm not as much of an Anglophile as I thought I was because I just don't believe that I recall garage being a thing. Or maybe I just thought it was horse and carriage. Maybe I don't know.
Yeah.
Hilarious, dude.
That's funny.
Well, you mentioned sort of where you grew up and its proximity to, you know, elsewhere. At which point did you even start playing drums then? And what do you remember your first drum set?
Yeah, I do. So I started playing drums fairly early once we'd moved up to Yorkshire. It was funny, actually, the whole reason why I started playing drums. I can remember going into like an assembly room and it was like, okay, you can play an instrument. What do you want to play? And my brother played trumpet.
Okay.
Okay. And I can remember thinking, well, I want to play trumpet too, because I'll be better than he will.
There you go.
You know, it was purely competition, you know. And by the time it came around to like saying, well, you can do it and you can do it, it literally was like that, I think. It was like you and you.
Right.
You know? And then it was, oh, the trumpet class is full. All right. So it was like, well, what can I play? And they said, well, there's room in the drum class. So I said, well, I'll do that then. You know? I didn't choose it, again, because I'd seen anybody or heard anything. I'll be honest, it was because you got about 20 minutes out of class at the time, you know? So you'd go out for your music lesson. Yeah. So I was like, well, of course I want to learn an instrument. 20 minutes to bunk out the class, you know? So that's, I mean, the completely uninspirational way of, you know, why I decided to play drums. And but I found myself just absolutely loving it, you know? Again, a classic case, it came to me. I didn't think of it or go to it. It really was, you know, it came to me.
Yeah.
So I'd have been, I'm going to say I was 7 or 8 years old, probably 8, I'm guessing. I remember just going into this class with two other guys, and we'd, you know, just have snare drums and toms in front of us, and we'd learn just some, you know, basic kind of, you know, rudiments, all that kind of stuff, you know, just sticking right, left, right, left, right, right, left, left, all that kind of stuff. And it just went from there, really. And then the first drum kit was an old Premier APK in black.
Okay.
I remember the floor tom still being like what was classed as the pre-international thing, so that it wasn't a 16 inch, it was 16 and a half.
Some strange dimension,
It was a strange dimension, which didn't matter to me at the time. I wasn't going to go breaking any skins or anything.
Yeah.
And I can remember my dad coming home with it, and I was just like bowled over. You know, I can still think of it now. And he came up the driveway where we lived, and as he turned the corner of the drive that we had, I just saw the bass drum with Premier written on it.
Nice.
And I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. You know, because up until then I'd started off on just pots and pans and Tupperware tubs, you know, and then my mum and dad bought me a snare drum. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, because I kept going with it, right, now you can have a kit. And so it just went from there. I mean, I can even remember the television program that was on when we did it. It's a real imprint on my mind.
Clearly.
You know?
Did your brother want to play the kit too? Was he mad that you got a kit or no?
No, he was playing trumpet, and he was quite happy doing the brass side of things. Okay. I mean, he would later go on to play trombone and baritone and learn piano. I did piano as well. But yeah, he was kind of more, and to this day, has kind of remained more like schooled in terms of, you know, music and parts. And, you know, he was definitely down that route. And I did concert bands and orchestras. I learned all that kind of stuff. But I guess there was always this little side of me that didn't really want to read the thing that somebody put in front of me.
Yeah, same here.
I'd be like, that doesn't sound right, you know? So I was like, I was playing in a concert band, a City Leeds youth concert band, which was, you know, a great thing to play in at the time. And I learned a lot from it. Mm-hmm. But I can remember playing actually a Beatles medley piece, you know? And I'm there thinking, but it doesn't go like that. That's not what I heard. So I would play what was on the record.
Right.
And the conductor would stop and go, well, that's not what's written. And I'm like, but it's wrong. You know?
Yeah.
So I would just say, look, but the guy who wrote that isn't a drummer. So hence he didn't know what to write. I've listened to the music. I know that that's how to play it.
Yeah.
So we'll do it that way.
Right.
And we would have various, not arguments, but little disagreements. But we eventually came to an agreement that there's certain things you can do your way, but then there's certain things I need you to do it my way.
There you go.
And we ended up having a wonderful relationship, actually. It was great.
Nice. So I kind of had a similar aversion, if you will, to reading sheet music. I've never really loved it, despite being in, you know, like marching band or jazz band. I was in a talented music program. The time where I read it the most, I was taking drum lessons when I was in college with a couple of guys. So then I really did kind of have to read at least those specific written segments. And you know, that was cool. But since then I've gotten books and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to get to them. And then I realize, yeah, probably not. So I hear you. But, at which point do you remember, I guess, when did you first start playing gigs or like gigging even with a band?
So with the orchestras and the concert bands, we would do shows that were like, you know, local in Leeds and, you know, that kind of area, like the town halls, etc. And then I remember we did like a little tour in Austria, I think it was, with that band, which was a really cool experience. Mm-hmm. And then, so, you know, that was like, I guess, the first kind of real experience of playing live, you know. But as far as bands are concerned, there was a school band I was in called The Regarded. which that was my first kind of experience of A, playing in a band, mm-hmm. you know, a rock band as such, where I think the first song I ever played with that band was Take It Easy, you know, right. by the Eagles. I can remember going in and playing that. But then we played songs by, you know, the Smiths and Oasis. And,
okay.
You know, there was a whole mix of stuff. But then there was the original material that we did as well.
Okay.
So that was kind of the first experience, you know, kind of doing that. But a lot of the early kind of me playing early were very much actually like they were pit orchestras and things like that to do with, mm-hmm. You know, playing shows and, you know, kind of not West End shows as in the West End, but, you know, musicals.
Right.
So my early playing career was not particularly rock and roll, really. Mm-hmm. It was very much more kind of the schooled side of it. But again, I would always come up against that whole, somebody would put a chart in front of me and I'd be like, I don't like that.
Right.
I don't want to play that. You know, but luckily, actually, there was an MD who I worked with and for a lot that actually was really cool about that. You know, he was like, yeah, you just do your thing. And if it doesn't sound right, I'll tell you. And we'll, you know, so that was, yeah, I was quite fortunate that I had people around me that when I say let me do what I wanted to do, it was always in the context of the song. But, mm-hmm. you know, they didn't hold me to the dot.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the rock band stuff came, you know, as I got into my teens and early 20s. You know, then it became, you know, more four or five guys in a garage or a garage.
There it is.
You know, and you know, playing tunes and writing and stuff, and yeah, it kind of started from there, really. But I've always had, you know, through all time, I've always had some form of affiliation with the music industry, whether it's been work. I used to work for Pearl, for example.
Okay.
You know, so I've worked for Pearl Drums, I've worked for Yamaha.
Oh, nice.
As well as, you know, the playing side of things. So I've always been around the MI as such, you know.
Okay.
Got to meet great players and spend time with, you know, great players within that kind of context as well. So,
yeah.
You know, Todd Suckerman, Omar Hakim, Gary Husband, you know.
Yeah.
So that's a massive thing as well, because then you kind of, again, you're just learning and absorbing mm-hmm. all this information from them. So,
damn.
So yeah, that was a pretty cool period of time.
Nice. Is this the most touring you've done since you've joined Wishbone Ash?
Yeah, it is. So prior to Wishbone Ash, I was at Yamaha.
Okay.
So I was doing that side of the MI at the time. I'd kind of moved away from playing. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I'd still play from time to time, but I wasn't really actively seeking to play. I was actually at the time working for Yamaha's guitar division.
Okay.
You know, so I didn't even actually have anything to do with drums at the time.
Damn.
But again, I was always around. It was always kind of nearby.
Mm-hmm.
The playing thing came up actually because of Wishbone, because of Mark. So the gig came about because the drummer before me, Joe Crabtree, was always going to leave, and he was leaving partway through a tour.
Oh.
Because they'd got married and just had a kid. So he wanted to move away from the touring side of things and settle down and do that. So he was always going to leave mid-tour, and they had another guy to take over for the rest of the tour. But unfortunately, Joe caught COVID. This was in 21. So, of course, at the time where if you caught it, you had to just lock yourself away in a cupboard, you know?
Yeah.
And they were due to play in Leeds that night, which is Mark's hometown and basically, you know, my hometown.
Yeah.
And he rang me and said, can you play tonight, you know?
Damn.
And I said, with you guys? And he went, yeah. I said, no, I can't. And he said, well, what, you know, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm shopping with my wife, actually. I'm out having a day off. So, and he said, we really need your help. And I said, mate, I've not played for ages, you know, and particularly I'm not gig fit, you know?
Right.
And he said, but we really need your help. So after going back and forth for 20 minutes or so, I agreed to go to a sound check with the guys. So I knew the music because, as I said before, you know, I'd kind of, you know, started to seek out the music. Eventually I was listening to it a lot. So I was aware of all the songs, and it was very familiar. So I agreed to come do a sound check, and I said, if it goes well, I said, I'll play the gig. If it doesn't, I said, no offense taken. We'll just go into town. We'll have a few beers, go for something to eat and enjoy the evening together. Cause mm-hmm. by that time I knew everybody anyway. So we were all friends.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went and did the sound check. It went okay. I played the show, and then I played two other shows before the next guy came in and finished off the tour. So that was like my introduction to playing with Wishbone.
Gotcha.
And then as time moved by, eventually my first tour with the band was in February of 2022, which was in the US. First gig was up in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And so no rehearsals, no pre-production, nothing, just boom, straight
right
in.
Into it.
Straight into it. So,
damn.
You know, obviously, you know, you do your homework and you play and you do your stuff, but it's not quite the same as getting together with all the guys, you know?
I know,
and,
I know.
It was a learning curve, but it was great. Guys were really supportive and, you know, that helped a lot. So, yeah,
that's
not looked back since. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
I know y'all are coming to the States. I'll have to look up your dates. I'm assuming we just get that at, like on the band's website.
Yeah, if you go on to wishboneash.com, it's on there. You can check out all the dates. I think this one coming up now, we start in Florida and we kind of go around the panhandle through to New Orleans and then through like Arizona and across to California. And then next year, we also start in Florida because we do the cruise to the edge.
Okay.
So we start there. So we start actually down in Miami. But once we've done that, we make our way back up. Kind of like the Midwest, so we do the, you know, east side again and
gotcha.
that kind of stuff. So
wow.
So yeah.
All right, man. Well, I'll have to keep my eyes peeled for some dates. That would it would be fun to see.
Yeah,
all,
just give me a shout, drop me a line, and we'll sort it out for you.
Right on. Sounds good. All right, Mike. Well, damn. Thanks for catching up, man. Appreciate
You're
the
welcome.
Time differential. I've been talking to quite a few people as of late in the UK, so I'm starting to get this whole time zone differential down
yeah.
a little better.
Yeah. I was trying to be mindful of that when we were trying to arrange it. I'm like, you know, because most of the time I'll probably be in the hotel rooms till 11-ish kind of normally over here is like a
yeah.
checkout, but I'm still thinking, well, that's a bit early for you over there.
Be about 6 a.m. yeah.
Exactly. And then you're kind of thinking, well, you want to make sure that there's enough time. So today worked out great because, you know, we were here yesterday and we'd
right.
go do sound check in about an hour or so. So we had plenty of time today. So
sweet.
Yeah, it was all
right
good.
On. Excellent, man. Well, good luck on the rest of the run of the shows, man.
Thank
hopefully
you,
the rest of the year is strong for you and we'll have to catch up soon, man.
It'd be good to meet you in person.
Yeah, absolutely, man. All right, one and done, and then on to the next one. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks to Mike for finding the time to catch up. Keep your eyes and ears peeled for the next episode, as well as Wishbone Ash out on tour. Crash, bang, boom.